what happens when bad people give to good causes? That was a big question over the last year. The late Jeffrey Epstein was jailed after the Miami Herald reported on his large-scale sexual exploitation of girls and the soft plea deal after a previous arrest. He had been a big donor to nonprofits, university research groups, and more, and some of the groups that received his money are still trying to figure out how to respond. And the Sackler family had made big donations too, but now they face massive lawsuits for their aggressive marketing of opioid drugs via their company, Purdue Pharma. Tufts University removed the Sackler name from a building last month. Other organizations may follow suit. Our next guest says these cases and others raise questions for nonprofits and more fundamental questions for all of us, like why do we give, why should we give, and does our generosity sometimes make us feel justified to do some bad things? Patricia Illingworth is a professor of ethics in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Northeastern University and a lecturer in law at Northeastern University Law School. She's the author or editor of a number of books, including Us Before Me, Ethics and Social Capital for Global Well-Being, and Giving Well, The Ethics of Philanthropy. She wrote about these issues at the Conversation website. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Before we dig into some of the deeper issues, I want to look at a couple of the cases I just mentioned. Jeffrey Epstein giving to a lot of nonprofits and foundations, the MIT Media Lab in chaos since these stories came out. What do you take away from how the nonprofit world is reacting to his story in particular?
I think I appreciate Edo's, for example, Mr. Edo's resignation. I was impressed with the from the Media Lab. I was impressed with the response by many stakeholders, including staff at the Media Lab. So I think there was a, you know, I feel like we're in a time of norm change, and some of these institutions are leading the way. I don't think Media Lab acted appropriately at the beginning, but I think that over time they sort of, you know, did a better job of recognizing the problem.
Now, you raise a concept that I hadn't been familiar with until I read your piece of moral licensing. Where can you explain that to us? What do you mean by that?
Well, moral licensing is a psychological process, I think pretty much unconscious, in which people perform good acts, and then they feel entitled to some extent to perform a bad act. So they have a kind of moral credentials. They create moral credentials that allow them to do something bad. And that might be something like, you know, being on a diet for a few weeks and doing a really good job with it, and then, you know, eating a pint of ice cream. So you follow your good actions with a bad action. Or it could be, which is what I explored in the conversation piece, it could be giving money to a nonprofit and then following that with something bad.
So in a sense, a donor might see some kind of cosmic balance sheet and say, well, I've done all this good stuff, so I am justified in doing these bad things. Is that right?
Right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That would be how it works.
Are we all at risk of moral licensing, even if we're not a wealthy donor, writing off our bad behavior because we say, well, we've got something good on the other side of the ledger?
I think most of us are vulnerable to that. I think probably there's some variation, and some studies suggest that people who have very strong moral convictions are better at managing their licensing. I mean, basically being very moral is something that's critical to them, so they tend to be more consistent. People who are, you know, who are sort of engaged in this balancing, you know, are more likely to engage in moral licensing.
Well, that raises an even more fundamental question of why do we give and why should we give? How do you encourage people to think about their generosity, whether we're giving $10 or, I don't know, $10 million?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, in the sort of philanthropy and ethics area, which is a relatively new area, there are a number of people who argue against philanthropy in and of itself on the grounds that it undermines democracy. So you have these billionaires who are giving huge amounts of money, and then they get to determine the social agenda. So a number of people in the field object to philanthropy in and of itself. What I do really is think about it more in terms of a of what are the obligations given philanthropy. I would much rather it were the case that everybody had their needs met through, you know, the state. But that's not the situation that we're faced with right now. So the question is, under these circumstances, how should philanthropy be conducted? And I think that I believe that we, all of us, have a duty to do as much as we can for other people, and that it's a global duty, and that we should be effective at it. So there is a movement called effective altruism, and I think I fall into that. But I would just temper it a bit and say that, for me, I think we need to be guided by human rights.
We're talking about Patricia Illingworth from Northeastern University, looking at the ethics of philanthropy and the ethics of giving after some high-profile questions raised, high-profile incidents raised questions about nonprofits and donors who have done bad stuff along the way. And that human rights focus, Patricia, talk about that a little, please.
Well, the idea is that if, you know, one of the problems, I think, with the effective altruism movement, which says give as much as you can and give effectively, is that you could give to causes that undermine human rights. So, for example, you might give to a developing country because you'll get a big bang for your buck in terms of, you know, life extension. But at the same time, that country may be involved in trafficking children, or, you know, employing children for various kinds of jobs, violating human rights in some way. So for me, it's a concern, and I think we can kind of control to some extent where the money is going by saying, let's focus on human rights, such as health, such as education. Now, it's a very broad category. There are a lot of human rights, and so one problem is, how do you narrow them? But it seems to me that rather than have simply a, you know, an open field, some guidance is needed.
I want to turn to the outlook from a nonprofit or a foundation or what have you, the groups receiving donations. Do they have an obligation to screen who's giving them money?
Yes, I think they do. And I think one of the important points about moral licensing is that what it suggests is that donors can... It's not just a matter of sort of, you know, moral cleansing or, you know, reputation laundering, which sort of looks at the status quo and says, we can protect this person. What moral licensing does is says that this person is going to do something bad in the future. And because they're going to do something bad in the future, and we can do something to prevent that, nonprofits can, we have a duty to prevent the harm. Otherwise, we're complicit in it.
We're talking to Patricia Illingworth, ethics professor at Northeastern University. We're looking at the ethics of giving and philanthropy after high-profile cases that have nonprofit groups doing a lot of soul-searching. Think of Jeffrey Epstein or the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should a nonprofit group refuse money that comes from a donor tainted by controversy or illegal or unethical behavior? When you give money, big or small, what motivates you to do it? What, if anything, do you think you get out of it? If you work at a nonprofit group yourself or some organization that takes donations, does your organization screen donors to avoid these kind of ethical quandaries and controversies? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the ethics of giving and philanthropy after controversial high-profile donors have raised questions about whether nonprofits should take their money in the first place, Jeffrey Epstein being the biggest story in that category, not the only one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should nonprofits refuse money from tainted sources, or if it's being used for a good cause, does it matter where the money comes from? When you give money to an organization or group, why do you do it? And if you work in a group that receives donations, What do you look for? Do you have concerns about who is giving the money, what they may have done in their personal lives or business lives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Patricia Illingworth stays with us from Northeastern University, editor of the book Giving Well, The Ethics of Philanthropy. Patricia, how about that idea that, okay, if I'm in a group and we're doing good work and we could do it with the money that came from whoever, does it matter what the source is?
Well, I think it matters in the with respect to moral licensing, because it may be that by using the money of somebody who is prone to moral license, you are causing harm in the world. You're complicit in harm in the world. And even if you take a kind of, you know, cost-benefit analysis stance, it might be the case that you are causing more harm to other people than you are getting good for the people within your nonprofit. So in the case of the Sacklers, for example, it may be, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that the harm caused by OxyContin was far greater than any of the benefits that came from the various institutions that took their money.
And what do you think of the idea? I mentioned earlier Tufts University being one case of them taking the Sackler name off of some of their buildings. Are there things that a group can do to repair that that harm retroactively?
Well, I think that, if I understand the question, I think that certainly removing the name is important. I mean, I have had students at Northeastern, we don't have any buildings that are named after the Sacklers, but I have had students who have lost siblings to the opioid crisis. And I've been grateful that we didn't have any buildings that said Sackler on them, you know, because I think it is a reminder, and it is problematic for young people to be in that kind of environment. I would imagine that talking to stakeholders, whoever's involved, and apologizing, which is to some extent what MIT did, is a good step in dealing with those who may be harmed by these various donors.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Milwaukee. Lynn, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, what do you want to tell us about, Lynn?
Well, I do have some background working with a local foundation here in Milwaukee as a student at one point in my life. And I really come away with the idea that because I came from a demographic where there was such strong need, that it really doesn't matter. It's not for anyone to judge what people do. As long as that money is doing good for others, there are more people that are more desperate and need more help. That's my opinion.
Lynn, thanks for that call. And Lynn, bring up that point I'd raised earlier. Patricia, she sees the benefit if it's helping people. She wasn't too worried about who donated and why.
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern that I have in the case of moral licensing, which would not be true in all cases of bad donors, but in the case of moral licensing, we can actually prevent future harms to other people if we don't accept some donations and from people who are prone to moral licensing. And I think, you know, we all have a duty, and organizations have a duty not to cause harm to other people. If they accept money that leads to great harm, and possibly greater harm than the organization is going to do, more people will suffer than those who will benefit. And so that is a concern for me.
Thanks, Lynn, for the call at 800-642-1234. Patricia, is part of the problem the way we recognize donations? We name a building after you or a wing or an award or whatever. Is it the way we publicize our donors that contributes to this moral licensing, the recognition for their gift, whoever they might be?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about that, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think that it's just not clear. I mean, on the one hand, many people in the philanthropy and ethics business think that naming rights are a good idea because they increase donations. Basically, more people will donate if they get their name on something. and that, you know, if you are pro-philanthropy, that's a good thing. In terms of moral licensing, you know, moral licensing happens when given a person's individual view about themselves. So it's not so much how do other people in the world view them, but how do they view themselves morally. So if they've done something which they think is morally good and they value that, or they don't value it too much and they want to balance it with something bad, then they may actually see having their name up as something that undermines their moral credibility, right? That they're more modest and humble if they don't put their name up. So it's hard to say where that would figure in. I would say from another perspective that one concern I have about putting names up is that it really interferes with the public space. And this, I think, has to do with the concern with democracy. You know, what we want is people to go to museums and feel like, oh, this is my museum, right? This is something that belongs to my community, or a public park, for example, or a school. I mean, you know, schools, public schools rarely have the names associated with them, but there might be a lot of money from somebody. People want to believe that this belongs to the community. And if you have names up there, I think that can be a problem.
Talking to Patricia Illingworth, professor of ethics in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Northeastern University, lecturer in law there as well at their law school, author of books including Us Before Me, Ethics and Social Capital for Global Well-Being. We're talking about some of the ethics of philanthropy, what people get out of making donations, when nonprofits should think twice about taking donations. Patricia, you said as a line of study, this is pretty new, but it seems like these issues go back a long way. We think about the robber barons of the late 19th and early 20th century, bad reputations in their lives, and a lot of foundations ended up being named after them. Have we, even if it hasn't been a formal study, have we been wrestling with these issues for a long time?
I think we have been wrestling with them for a long time, but and my focus is really on contemporary philanthropy, but I think that there was a greater acceptance in the past of a kind of inequality, or the idea that you need to do bad things in order to get money to do good things. I think that might have been more widely accepted. And I think today there's a greater push, at least among some groups or people, for a more equal society that recognizes all people and doesn't necessarily want to justify bad behavior just because somebody's giving a donation.
Let's bring on another caller now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
I would like to count in companies that are damaging the environment, and I see them as morally corrupt too, and taking money from them for whatever reason to me is just crazy, like big oil or energy companies. I'd like to hear your guest thought on that.
Ray, thanks for the call. Patricia, what do you think about what Ray brought up?
Well, I think he's absolutely right, and there's actually been some research on moral licensing in the case of companies. And what they've shown is that companies that engage in more CSR, corporate social responsibility, also engage in more corporate social irresponsibility, and which is basically the same thing we're talking about with respect to individuals. And some of the work that I've been thinking about how to deal with moral licensing, is actually comes from some United Nations guidelines that John Ruggie came up with about 3 years ago on the duties of corporations and with respect to human rights, and basically saying that the best thing we can do to minimize human rights violations by corporations is to engage in due diligence, which is sort of what I've argued in this piece and in this piece in the conversation, and also in the book that I'm writing right now. So I agree wholeheartedly with that.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Patricia, what advice would you have for philanthropists at all levels to be good philanthropists and not to moral license themselves to behave badly in other spheres of their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think that we can all learn something. You know, we can learn how to not engage in moral licensing. And I think, one part of that is simply knowing that it happens and that we're prone to it. I think, donors can, are able to do that if it's a matter of concern. But to some extent, what the studies show is that it has to really matter to you to be moral in order to avoid moral licensing. It's if you are committed and you have a strong moral identity, then you pretty much will be consistent with your values and principles. If you don't, then you're more likely to engage in moral licensing. So part of it has to do with, you know, what your values are in the first place. And so I think part of this is there's a big job for ethicists and ethics courses in universities and maybe before universities in public school.
And in our last minute or so, Patricia, do you see maybe big changes in the works in the nonprofit world, in part because of what we've seen from Jeffrey Epstein and the Sackler family and other high-profile cases?
I think we're moving in the right direction, and the Tufts case, as you mentioned, is a good example of that. The forced resignation of Mr. Ito is a good example of that. Warren Kanders' resignation from the Whitney is a good example of that. I think, you know, society is, people are demanding that non-for-profits make more morally responsible decisions, and they're taking steps. They're being active to create a different model.
Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
That was Patricia Illingworth, ethics professor at Northeastern University, editor of the book Giving Well, The Ethics of Philanthropy. She joins us to talk about the ethics of giving and what happens when philanthropists do bad things while giving big money to causes. You can read more in an article we mentioned at the Conversation website. There's a link at WPR.org amongst our program notes. Coming up, it's a new year and a great time to set up some good new habits. A nutrition expert tells us how to bring healthier food into our daily lives, not just for a crash diet, but for years to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a look at ice fishing around the state and how families can get involved. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, New Year's resolutions are notoriously difficult to follow through with, at least for the long term, especially the ones where we're trying to do things like eat healthier, be more active. Our next guest has some advice on how to build better habits into our lives, especially when it comes to the food we eat, and maybe don't eat. Beth Olson is an associate professor and extension specialist in the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot of people don't make New Year's resolutions anymore, but I think they get that inkling of it's a new year, I'm going to change something. Do you see that as a trend? Even if we don't call it a resolution, we want to do something on the new year?
Yeah, I think it's an occasion that brings up newness. There are others. Sometimes when summer's coming, people, or spring or summer, when the weather's getting warmer, people also say, you know, I'm going to change something in my life. But I think January 1 just has that new sense about it, that people want to do something healthy.
And I get the sense often when it comes to food and some other things, we may have this great idea, but we don't have a plan. And we think we're just going to go in and we're going to have this endless reserve of willpower, and that's how we're going to carry it through. And that seems to me, having experienced it myself, like a recipe for failure. Am I right?
Oh, yes. I think when one has a broad, indefinite plan, like, oh, I'm going to exercise more, or I'm going to eat healthy, then there isn't any accountability, because you do something wrong one day, you think, well, oh, well, you know, it wasn't too bad. So what we would suggest is that people set smaller goals and set them with a timeline. So maybe you want to say, you know, in January, I'm going to walk at my lunch period or my lunch break 2 times a week for the month of January. So that gives you a timeline, a very definite activity, and it also then gives you some success when you achieve it.
And part of the problem there is we might say, I want to walk more. but that doesn't give us a concrete way. Part of the, one of the big steps here is not just what do I want to do, but how do I integrate it into my life, my work day or whatever part of my day it is.
Oh, exactly. You want to pick something that works for you. So, you know, if you're a very social person and maybe you're not a morning person, saying, well, I'm going to get up every morning at 5 a.m. and go down in the basement and walk on my treadmill isn't probably a good plan. It doesn't fit with your life. It doesn't fit with what you like. So choose something that's a little more achievable for you, fits in with your life. Maybe it's something you like to do already, you just would like to do more. Or maybe you do want to try something new, something you've always wanted to do and you've never tried before.
Talking to Beth Olson from the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department, trying to set up some good habits in the new year. Well, let's take food and focus in on that a little bit. What kind of things can we do to build a healthier food habit into our lives?
Well, I think some of the same things apply with a healthy food habit. So again, not just saying, well, I'm going to eat better or I'm going to eat more healthy, because that isn't measurable to you. It doesn't really have any accountability. So perhaps you want to look at your what you're doing now and think of what you want to change and then pick one thing to work on, maybe, again, month of January or for the week. So you might say, for my afternoon snack, instead of going down to the vending machine in my building, I'm going to bring from home a piece of fruit. And I'm going to do that every day this week or 2 days a week, or set some goal you think is realistic for you. And then when you achieve some success, move on to the next thing. What's the next thing you'd like to improve?
Having talked to people on shows about nutrition before and having worked on a health show, Zorba Pastor on Your Health Some, I think a lot of people get really focused on, is this particular food good or bad for me? Eggs, are they good or bad for me? What are some of the things, though, that we know 100% are low-hanging fruit that if we make this habit change, we're going to be healthier in the long run?
Yeah, well, you set that one up well, because I would say it's probably fruits and vegetables. And some of us eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, but we don't eat a very wide variety. So one thing you might try is, you know, I'm going to pick a couple of new fruits, or I'm going to pick a couple of new vegetables and try them this week. And, you know, if you don't like them, okay, pick another couple next week and try them. But I think the widest variety, often we look at that in color in your vegetables, would be a great thing to do. And the second thing, from my just training over many years in the nutrition world, that I think is a wonderful marker of things that would help in your diet is fiber. So we get really caught up in, you know, are blueberries good because they have some antioxidant in them? Is this thing good? I think if you pick a lot of foods that are high in fiber, you're going to have a pretty good diet.
Give us a little quick list of easy to add to our diet things that will bring that fiber.
So fruits and vegetables, of course, that's a big one. Another one, though, is whole grains. So if you're a big white bread, white roll eater, maybe try eating a whole wheat bread or whole grains such as rice. Instead of white rice, try some brown rice. So all of the grains that you can make whole really will help increase your fiber.
And for people out there who complain, oh, I see news stories that say this is good one day, this is bad the next day, we're never going to see a study that says fruits and vegetables, bad for you, skip them.
I've never seen one.
So that's good low-hanging fruit. How about stuff, now you're looking on the positive side, good things to add. How about the stuff on the negative side of our nutrition ledger? What is some of the low-hanging fruit, or non-fruit, I guess, in this case, that you see people eating, drinking that would be good first steps to get rid of?
Of course, one would be sugar-sweetened beverages. So sodas, iced teas with a lot of sugar in them. That's a pretty easy way to remove calories without hurting your nutrients, because they don't have many nutrients. The other thing would be to look at probably how you're snacking. So a lot of times we like chips or crackers, and nothing wrong with that on occasion. But looking at, okay, are there some things missing in my diet I could put in via my snacks? So maybe some seeds or lentils, not lentils, sorry about that, nuts, something a little more, you know, still tasty, but a little more nutritious than, say, chips.
And it seems like we want to look at the role that snack plays in our life, what it's doing in a particular time of day, what we're doing. How do we get the right mental and emotional states to be ready to give up that yummy, I don't know, cookie that the radio host goes and gets every afternoon and replace it with that healthier stuff?
Yes, I think sometimes people don't think about the role that food plays in our social life and our emotional life. So some things are comfort foods. Sometimes, you know, we watch TV, so we like to munch on popcorn. So I don't think we need to give all those things up. We just have to look at them and think, how much of it am I doing? Can I maybe not add as much butter to my popcorn? Because popcorn actually is a great source of fiber. Or maybe my cookie can be a little bit smaller. Or maybe I can alternate my cookie with a granola bar that's a little more healthy. And I would say if there's a time that you really want to indulge, we just had the holidays and there was desserts and Christmas cookies and things like that. Don't beat yourself up over it. Go ahead and have a little and enjoy it and then move on the next day to something else.
We're talking to Associate Professor Beth Olson from the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department about building better food habits in the new year or anytime. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made a health-related resolution for 2020? Or even if you don't call it a resolution, are you trying to improve some health habit, whether it's food or exercise or something else along those lines? Have you broken one yet here on January 2nd? No judgment. Do you have a plan for sticking to your plan? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Nutritional Sciences Professor Beth Olson about keeping those resolutions we set for ourselves to be healthier in the new year, how to build better habits when it comes to food, exercise, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you successfully improved a health habit, adding healthier food to your diet, maybe taking some bad stuff out, getting regular exercise that you didn't used to, or other improvements? How'd you do it? What worked for you? Were there failures along the way that you learned from? Do you have questions for our guest about making and keeping healthier resolutions, about building better, healthier eating and other health habits? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Beth, I hear with a lot of negative health behaviors, whether it's smoking, problem drinking, addiction, or overeating, eating bad stuff. Sometimes it's a symptom of things like stress, anxiety, depression. How can we spot that and realize what that negative health behavior is kind of coming from and deal with that fundamental problem?
Yeah, it might help to do something like keeping a food journal. So you write down what you eat and what you're doing at the time. And then in retrospect, you can look back and go, oh, that was right after this conversation, or that was every time I visit, you know, my some member of my family where I feel stressed, or it's after work. And then look at, okay, is there something else that I could replace that with? Can I take a walk? Can I have a big glass of water and take some deep breaths instead of reaching for something else?
And that makes a lot of sense because it seems to be, again, that if my approach is going to be don't do the bad thing at this stressful time, that's really hard to pull off without that replacement.
Yes, it's always easier, I think, to replace a bad habit with a healthy habit than it is to just get rid of the habit and then be feeling lost of how to cope.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Justin with us in Black Creek. Justin, hi.
Hi there. I will be following the ketogenic diet. I will continue it as I've been doing it since June 2018. And it reversed my diabetes and I lost some weight on it. And I'm feeling 100% better. So I'll be sticking to that diet.
And Justin, at the outset, was it hard for you to stick to it, you know, at the beginning?
At the beginning, when I was not aware of the alternatives, it was difficult. But once I found out different recipes and stuff, how to make things at my home, it was a lot easier, and it has been since.
Justin, thanks a lot for that call. And whether is somebody's doing a keto diet or a particular diet, something that struck me there was once he found out some recipes, once he found some ways to work within the system instead of just trying hard.
Yeah, and I think when people stumble on something they really want to achieve, instead of just saying, well, I can't do it, I'm going to give up, or I'm not a good person because I didn't have the willpower, they should just get back up and say, okay, why did that happen? Like he's saying, you know, I didn't like the food. Okay, then perhaps that's not the diet for you or the eating pattern for you. Perhaps you need a different one or you need to get recipes. Or for anything, again, you know, maybe the treadmill isn't for you and walking outside is for you. So if you stumble, I would say don't give up. I saw a study in which they estimated how long it took someone to change a habit, and the range was 18 to 254 days. So you think, how often do you say I'm going to do something and you give up long before even 18 days, much less 254? So depending on a person in the habit, it might take a little while of trying and trying again.
Thanks, Justin, for that call at 800-642-1234. Yeah, when I've talked to some smoking cessation experts at UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, for example, they say reframe things. You didn't fail that first quitting attempt. You took your first step toward quitting, and it might be the third or seventh or 12th step that is actually the successful one.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, you have to give yourself credit for trying. You know, you've gotten up the willpower to say, I really want to make this change. I'm going to try it, and I'll keep trying until I get the result that I want.
Thanks, Justin, again, for that call. So what are some achievable New Year's resolutions? We've touched on this a little bit. What are some things you might recommend to people who have sort of like a vague sense, like I could do better, but don't really have a concrete plan on what that could be?
Yeah, so I'd pick something very simple to start if you're not doing much in an area which you want to improve. I think a lot of people underestimate the power of walking. You don't have to join and pay for a gym and go to the gym and run on the treadmill and run till you drip sweat. You can go to the mall here in Wisconsin when it's cold, and we can't always walk outside. You can go to the mall and just walk up and down the mall, see how many times you can do it before you're fatigued, and the next day, see if you can go a little bit longer. So I think walking, and there's a lot of opportunities in terms of, you know, not taking elevators and parking your car far away from your work, that kind of thing. And then in terms of eating, I think, as we said before, you know, maybe just picking a few items that you would like to include in your diet and starting with those and not worrying about cutting a whole bunch of things out and adding a whole bunch of things and throwing everything up in the air on, which really just can make it hard.
Now, one thing that just anecdotally from callers over the years I've heard people get discouraged by is we think the goal of eating better and exercising is weight loss. And we do a good thing, but we don't see it on the scale. And people think, well, it's not working. What do you say to them?
Well, weight loss shouldn't always be our goal. Certainly, there's times when people feel like they would like to lose some weight, and perhaps a doctor has told them they need to. But we're really interested in other measures of our health, things like our blood pressure and our blood lipids and how well we control our blood glucose. One of the callers mentioned, or the caller mentioned, dealing with diabetes.
Right.
So those are the things that are really associated with having a long, healthy life. And, you know, weight loss can contribute if someone is overweight. But even for people who are not overweight, it's important to be active and eat healthy so that all these other measures of health are as good as they can be.
So even if the number on the scale isn't going down, if we're more active, if we're eating a little bit better, it is paying dividends short and especially long term?
Yes, and I think people will feel it. They'll feel more energetic. They'll feel more healthy. And I think it's also good for our mind. When we know that we're doing well for ourselves, then we also, I think, are feel less stressed and feel more happy with ourselves.
Let's talk about, this is maybe veering into psychology outside of nutrition, but, and you've touched on this a little bit, guilt and how to avoid avoid being guided by guilt here.
Yes, and that's just an unfortunate history we've had in nutrition where people have felt like there's good foods and bad foods, and if I eat the bad foods, I feel guilty. And so we really want to move away from that. We want to say, you know, indulge in what you love a little bit and look at more options and find things that are healthy that you do enjoy. And then enjoy your food. Sit down at the table, chew well, enjoy your food, eat with others, turn the TV off, and really enjoy what you're eating and don't feel guilty.
Well, I'm feeling a little guilty because of my lunches sitting at my desk at work. Is that something that we should maybe try to veer away from?
I do that too. So we should. And I think, for instance, in our family, we're doing better in terms of eating together at dinner time. So that's a time where we can sit together and talk and enjoy our food and enjoy each other's company.
Well, Beth, thanks again for the New Year's inspiration.
Thank you.
That's Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department. We talked to her today about strategies for building healthier habits, especially eating habits in the new year. Still time for you to share your experiences, maybe your successes, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cannabidiol, or CBD oil, has presented countless business opportunities and helped relieve seizures for children with a rare form of epilepsy. But Wisconsin's approval of the substance in 2014 has also opened up a can of worms. As Shemaine Mills reports, this creates a dilemma for agencies which oversee the substance and the researchers who study it.
So what this is called is a vortexer. So it's a way of actually mixing things by spinning them really fast. So
Cecilia Hillard is a professor of pharmacology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. As she washes a laboratory beaker, she explains how she studied the anti-inflammatory properties of CBD, a marijuana extract that doesn't get people high.
It clearly reduces the response of the body to inflammation, and I do think that this is one of the more promising effects of CBD. We've been studying it a little bit in some other things that haven't shown much effect. We've looked at it in animal models of pain, and it has not been very effective.
But don't tell that to Ryan Barnes.
I'm all for it. CBD has been a life changer not only for me, but for a lot of other people I know.
Barnes recalls how he used to take prescription medication to control anxiety while in college, trying to juggle studies and work at the same time.
The stress is real.
But how effective is the cure? It depends on what condition you're trying to alleviate. Hillard says a study from Germany suggests that CBD may be a good treatment for schizophrenia. Research in New York indicates it might help prevent cravings in heroin addicts. But other uses?
It's hard to really recommend it because we have not been able to do placebo-controlled studies in human beings. So you get concerned that there's a lot of expectation, particularly for things like sleep or anxiety, where the end point can be quite subjective.
Hillard laments that CBD oil is being used in ways that may not help or could even hurt people. For example, she notes it's being used by parents to treat ADHD and autism in children. Pregnant women are taking it to treat nausea and pain. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has advised against using cannabis and its more straight-laced cousin, CBD, while pregnant. The agency has also issued warning letters to companies making claims about CBD, which the government says are not substantiated.
Consumers should know that CBD products that are on the market today have not received FDA review or approval.
That's Patricia Kelmar, Director of Health Policy for the National Consumers League. The group says sales of unregulated products are soaring and more needs to be done to ensure people and pets are safe.
Show you around.
I recently visited a CBD store near the UW-Madison campus called the Green Barn Door. Sure enough, they're banking on at least some of their customer base being canines.
So this is our pet section over here, and the bowl is just, you know, in case people want to walk in with their furry little friend. And yeah, we got drops, we got pet treats, we got, you know, sprays you can put on their food.
Ryan Barnes not only uses CBD, he oversees sales for the Green Barn Door, and they sell pretty much anything you can imagine, only with CBD oil in it.
Is that really caramel sauce with CBD oil?
Yeah, just in time for the holidays.
Any chocolate here?
Like other retailers selling CBD, they hope sales will continue to grow.
Hey, will that be all for you?
As over-the-counter purchases of CBD rise, researchers like Hillard would like to see more regulation. Without it, she says, the potential of CBD as a proven drug may never be realized beyond controlling seizures in kids. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new year means new changes in healthcare plans for a lot of people. An expert tells us what to watch out for in the fine print and make sure we make the best use of our benefits, whether we change plans or not. Our reporters from around the state bring us the biggest stories in Wisconsin from 2019, from major flooding to a high-profile abduction case that captured national attention. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with a focus on better, healthier, and tastier options for breakfast time. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Keeley Boltina in this week for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Keeley talks to leaders from Wisconsin's Republican and Democratic parties about a big year ahead with Wisconsin in the national spotlight. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the importance of having close friends in your life and some ideas on how to build and maintain those kind of relationships. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.